But I mean, I was just thinking about things like going to the library and looking for articles and physically copying them and like wondering, do I have enough quarters to copy all the articles I need to take away with me? Or, oh my gosh, having to go and work with the microfilm. That was like my nemesis, the microfilm machine. I was looking at really old stuff. So I think there are a lot of ways in which technology has made the job of doing research and scholarship a lot easier. We have the access to materials and to other scholars is incredible.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Greetings and welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. We are so excited to be here today. I'm here with my co-host, Tiffany Snyder. Welcome, Tiffany.
Hi, Brad. Hi, everyone.
And before I introduce our guest for today, I just want to say something about her. This is the person who actually taught me how to write, someone I've collaborated with over the last 10 years, and that is Tracy Skipper. Tracy Skipper has more than 20 years of experience in academic publishing, specializing in acquisitions and content development of research and practice literature in higher education. Her scholarly interests include the application of cognitive structural development to composition pedagogy and the use of writing in first-year seminars and senior capstone courses. For the past 20 years, Tracy has been a driving force in the creation of high-quality scholarly and educational resources at the National Resource Center for the First-Year Experience and Students in Transition. Tracy wrote the best-selling text, Student Development in the First College Year, a primer for college educators, and envisioned and served as the managing editor for the five-volume series, The First Year Seminar, Designing, Implementing, and Assessing Courses to Support Student Learning and Success. She also co-authored the volume, Writing in the Senior Capstone, Theory and Practice. Tracy has a bachelor's degree in psychology, master's degrees in English and higher education, and a doctoral degree in English with a focus on composition and rhetoric. Tracy's extensive expertise in the writing process, along with her teaching experiences at the college level and numerous conference presentations, have led her to create a freelance business that focuses on editing and coaching services for higher education professionals. We have provided links to Tracy's blog on the Digital to Learn webpage. We're pleased now to welcome Tracy Skipper to the Digital to Learn podcast. Welcome, Tracy.
Hi, Brad. Hi, Tiffany. Thanks for having me today.
So glad to be here with you.
Yes.
We're going to have some fun today, and you're going to teach us more about how to write and how people can learn how to write. So we'll get into that in a minute. But one of the first things that we'd like to do is just get to know the guests a little bit. And so we asked some embarrassing, ridiculous questions to do that. One of the things I know about Tracy from Facebook, because I always saw pictures of the food creations that she had made. And I think you also had a blog at one time, is that correct?
I did. I would post what I was cooking for dinner, and one of my friends from high school said, oh, you should start a blog. So I started a blog called Real Woman Cooks, and I did that for probably 3 or 4 years, and it just got exhausting. Like, you would cook, you would take a picture, and then you'd have to type up this thing about what you ate. So it's still out there. You can find it and check out some cool recipes. None that I created myself. It was always, I was just getting a recipe from somebody else and telling you, this is what I did with it.
So part of our deal with Tracy was for her to be on the podcast, but she also has to have us over for dinner. So when we come to her house for dinner, what are you going to cook to impress us?
Well, I've given a lot of thought to this because I am not a fancy cook, but I also think we tend to eat pretty well in our house. But I have some rules about my cooking, and I want to have dinner on the table in about 45 minutes. And the enjoyment factor, the flavor factor, has to be in inverse proportion to the number of pots that I dirty while I'm cooking. So, like, I love a sheet pan meal, any kind of one pot dinner, that's going to be what we're having. But I would, to fancy it up a little bit for you, Brad, and for Tiffany, I would maybe do some pan-seared scallops, sauteed spinach with little cannellini bean. This is something we've done for holiday meals when it's been just our small family and really enjoyed it. The other thing I have been cooking recently for special occasions that looks so complicated but is so simple is a chocolate lava cake.
Ooh.
I found this recipe in Melissa Clark's Instant Pot cookbook called Comfort in an Instant. She's a New York Times food writer. And you can prep the whole thing ahead of time. And then when you're ready to cook it, you just put your little ramekins in your Instant Pot. And 10 minutes later, you have this most delicious, intense chocolate dessert. It looks like you've really done something fancy, and it's been super easy. So you can impress, awesome. Impress all your friends and neighbors with your cooking.
We're going to be leaving right after this podcast, hopping on a plane. So we should be there about 6 o'clock tonight. So we'll see you.
Great. Then. I'll be ready.
Excellent.
All right. Question two, what is your all-time worst online purchase?
So this is going to tell you a little bit about me. And that is, last night I scrolled through 20 years of my Amazon purchasing history to figure out what was the worst thing that I ever purchased online. And interestingly enough, it all had to do with herbs.
Oh,
so we just talked about cooking. And so it's like, I bought this OXO rolling herb mincer. And I don't remember what year, but I saw it. And it was one of these things I thought, oh, you know, I think Real Simple told me it was going to revolutionize cutting herbs. And it's like, it would mash the herbs and bruise them, but not really cut them. So I don't even think I have that thing anymore. But then there was also this herb keeper that you put a little water in the bottom, you put your herbs in it, stuck it in the fridge, and it was supposed to keep them fresh for much longer. And I don't know, that just thing never really worked out for me either. So they have to do with like failed cooking utensils.
So if we were to ask you to sing a song for us, and we're not going to do that.
Thank goodness.
So you don't have to worry about that. Well, what song would you pick?
It would probably be something by Billie Holiday, maybe like Lover Man or God Bless the Child. I discovered her when I was in high school, and I was in love, and I wanted, like, I had a secret aspiration of being a lounge singer, and probably I still do harbor that. And I still listen to a lot of jazz standards, so it'd probably be something from her.
Yeah. I wouldn't have predicted that.
I know. It's neat when we uncover, I guess, surprises. Can you share with us one or more of your favorite writers and why they are your favorites?
So this is, I hope this will also be a bit surprising. Jane Austen is one of my favorites, which with the background in literature, that's probably not all that surprising. But I was thinking about why, and I love the humor, but I also think about, even though she's writing in a very different time, in a very different place, there's still something that's really relatable about her work today. People are dealing with how do they define their destiny within these social constraints. They're trying to find romantic relationships. They're dealing with overbearing parents. And it's like, this is one of my goals in life right now, is to not be Mrs. Bennet as a mother. So this is kind of how I relate to Jane Austen. Another person I read quite a lot, very different time period and author, is Eric Larson. He's a historian, and I'm actually reading his latest book right now, The Splendid and the Vile, which is about Churchill's first year as prime minister. And this is when they're kind of on the brink of Germany invading Great Britain, and they're getting regular bombings and that sort of thing. But one of his most fascinating books is called The Devil in White City, where he juxtaposes these two stories. One is about the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. And there's this serial killer that sets up shop and is kind of preying on people who come to the World's Fair and who are there to help build it and work there, and then also who come and visit. And so it's just like this really interesting way that he tells stories in history that we maybe know something about, but we really get sort of the perspective of a person that maybe we haven't heard from before. Those would be my two. I mean, I could go on. I read a lot, and there are a lot of authors that I really admire.
Well, we'll have you back again to do some book reviews
okay.
for us. As I mentioned earlier, I had the pleasure and privilege of working with Tracy for over 10 years during her tenure at the National Resource Center for the First Year Experience and Students in Transition. And so benefited from her input and feedback. But Tracy, I'm guessing over your time as an editor and author, you have seen some dramatic changes in the ways that people write and the intrusion of technology into that process. What are some of those things that you've seen evolve over time?
Well, I don't know that I would say the intrusion of technology. I think there are a lot of ways in which technology has made the writing process easier. There's less friction, I guess I would say. You might have seen this, Brad. I was thinking about this earlier this week, and I went out and I found a picture of my first computer, which was a Commodore 64 Executive Portable.
A classic.
Portable in that it had a handle. It weighed 23 pounds.
Oh, my.
It had like a 5 1/4 inch floppy disk drive and a 5 inch screen. So now I've got like the latest MacBook Air. So you can see how much more computing power I have now versus what I had with that first one. But I mean, I was just thinking about things like going to the library and looking for articles and physically copying them and like wondering, do I have enough quarters to copy all the articles I need to take away with me? Or, oh my gosh, having to go and work with the microfilm. That was like my nemesis, the microfilm machine. I was looking at really old stuff. So I think there are a lot of ways in which technology has made the job of doing research and scholarship a lot easier. We have the access to materials and to other scholars is incredible now. I also think about things like I don't do a lot of research in terms of data crunching, that sort of thing, but I'm sure that the power of statistical packages has evolved in the last, you know, 10, 15 years. So now we have the ability to do these logistic regressions and HLM and all of these really sophisticated analytic techniques that help us know so much more about the data sets that we're looking at. Or from a qualitative researcher's perspective, you know, we now have packages that allow people to code their qualitative data. And this is, you know, these are things that, I mean, I've talked to qualitative researchers who are talking about, like, I had color-coded note cards, and these are like spread out all over my office or bedroom or whatever. And so I think those things just make it so much easier for us to manage the research process and the writing process. And I think for me, it's changed the way I am as a writer. I am much more willing to try things, to move things around, to cut things out of my document, because I might be saving versions. And so if I decide to cut something in version 3, I know it's going to be back there in version 2 if I decide later I need it. Mm-hmm. Or I will sometimes create a document that's just for things that get cut. And so I just dump things over there when I cut them. And I think that makes me more willing to take, they're not even really risks in my writing, but just I don't get so worried about making it perfect in that first draft. I mean, I think about, I did a thesis as a senior, and my father paid someone to type that paper for me so it could be bound in a book. Well, once that happened, I couldn't make any changes. So now it's like if I decide, oh, I don't like this word choice, or oh, I hear I've spelled something wrong, like I can fix that at the last minute. So I think there are some ways in which technology has really made the writing process easier. I'm sure there are lots of ways people will say that it has created intrusions.
I'm sorry I used that word. That was not
the right word. No, but well, I'm just thinking about there's also that temptation to get on social media and to see what's happening on Twitter when I should be reading an article. But but I think there's some real benefits to that.
That's a great analysis. Great.
Yeah. And right in line with our podcast too, we had a guest in the past year, Lai Ho of Delve, and she talked about qualitative coding made easy. And like you said, just not even more robust qualitative software, but actually simpler qualitative software that's available for the person who's new to that field. So there's just so many opportunities. We've touched a lot on opportunities. What would you say are some of the challenges that faculty face when it comes to their scholarly pursuits in today's era?
You know, I have done a lot of writing workshops over the years. And when I ask people what gets in the way of writing for them, and I think there are two themes. One is time. And the other is fear or anxiety. So it's maybe lack of confidence in their ability as writers or scholars, or a lack of confidence in finding an audience. So what I have to say won't matter to other people, or people are going to look at me and say, well, you're just a junior scholar. Why does what you have to say on this topic matter? So that's, we also hear that talked about in terms of imposter syndrome. And I think that some grad schools, I think, do a really good job of mentoring students around their writing and kind of teaching them how to be scholars and writers. But I think that's sort of hit and miss. So I think a lot of students aren't getting that. So they maybe aren't learning how to write. They aren't learning how to create a practice, how to manage time demands. I think one of the other things, as I was thinking about this, and I think we were hearing about this a lot over the last year because of the pandemic, you know, what's happening with women in terms of bearing the brunt of being at home with kids and, you know, managing homeschool, and how is that impacting scholarly productivity? I also thought about this in terms of scholars of color, because, you know, last May and June, the whole nation is really paying attention to racial injustice. And what happens is campuses say, oh, well, we have to respond. And who do they tap to respond? They tap the scholars of color. And so these people are dealing with kind of the emotional trauma of seeing police violence on their telephones. And then at the same time, they're being pulled out of their own scholarship to do this service for their institutions and for their communities. And I think we're seeing the same sort of thing happen right now with Asian American scholars when we talk about the Asian violence that's happening, or the violence against Asians. So I think there's also this need for us not just to say, oh, in general, people don't have the time, or in general, people have pulls, but to really think about who is it that gets pulled and doesn't have that time. We aren't even talking about contingent faculty, but they really don't have the time. And then they also might not even have the same kind of resources that tenure track faculty have. Like, do they have access to the library? Do they even have an office on campus where they can do scholarly work? So, I mean, I think there are all kinds of systemic things that are happening that get in the way as well. I think one of the other challenges for everyone right now is this increasing demand from a public to demonstrate the value and the relevance of your scholarly work. I think folks in the humanities probably feel this really intensely. And if you think about the current backlash against critical race theory and, you know, how scholars in the academy are dealing with those kinds of issues. So I think there are a ton of things that are kind of converging that make it really challenging for folks to get into writing, get into their scholarly pursuits. And we just have to think about, how do we help? I think there are systemic things we can do to manage that from the campus level. Organizations like your teaching and learning centers can help with that. But then I think there are some things that we can do to help people on an individual level. That was a very long-winded answer.
Powerful. Just great powerful.
Answer.
Yeah.
Great answer. Mm-hmm. Hey, that was fun. And if you enjoyed our conversation with Tracy Skipper, which I'm sure you did, then you'll be wanting to come back for episode 2. In the meantime, check us out on digitaltolearn.com. And as Tiffany always says, that's a numerical 2.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are 3 things we ask you to do. 1, come back and join us again. 2, tell your friends about us. And 3, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.